702 podcasts are on 702.co.za.
Josias Naidu is my guest. He's an audiologist. He joins me now. Josias, thank you so much for joining us this evening. What is an audiologist, Josias?
Hi, Aubrey, and thanks for having me.
Yes, sir.
An audiologist is a healthcare professional that focuses or specializes in identifying, diagnosing, and treating conditions that affect the auditory and the vestibular system. So very simply, they look at conditions that affect both the hearing and the balance systems, which are very, very important for as a sense in terms of our sense of hearing and our ability to be able to maintain our posture and balance in everyday lives.
Very interesting that hearing and the hearing and all of the I suppose senses connected to that have to do with balance, Josias. That's quite interesting. Talk to me a little bit more about that, the idea around balance and posture and the ability to use the sense of hearing.
Well, when we look at the organ that's responsible for hearing and balance, it's essentially one structure. The vestibular or hearing components. So it's your cochlea, which balances and focuses on the hearing aspect, and then the vestibular system, which consists of three semicircular canals, which assist the body to determine whether you're moving forward.
Josias? Sorry, I lost you there. The vestibular section of the ear, which helps the body do what?
To help the body. So in the vestibular portion of the inner ear, we have three semicircular canals.
Yes.
And these canals assist the body or assist the nervous system in determining whether the body is moving forward, backwards, left, right, up or down. So it gives you some form of perspective in terms of your movement and your positioning. And this combines with the sensory input from the rest of the nerves in your body, so the input from your legs and your spinal cord, and also with your visual inputs, so the input from your eyes. And these correlate, and it gives the brain the ability to determine your positioning. That's why very often people will say that when I'm on a ship, I tend to get very seasick. And seasick is pretty much just the brain's response to this imbalance. Because when you're standing in a big ship or moving on the water in a big vessel, a lot of the input would say that, you know, even if you look out, everything looks like it's steady. But the vestibular system is picking up that slight bobbing or shifting in your movement caused by the water. So there's an imbalance in what the eye is telling the brain and what the vestibular system is telling the brain. And that's why often people tend to find themselves a little bit dizzy or unsteady when they're traveling on water.
Oh, Josias, even as you explained that, I'm starting to feel a bit dizzy. 011-883-0702. Josias Naidu is my guest. He's an audiologist. You know what comes to mind now, even as you say that, is the idea of bats, right? And the fact that they fly around at night and they are as blind as bats proverbially are, or practically are, and they use sound to get direction. Has this remotely connected to what you're explaining to me now? You see, I'm fascinated by the relationship of sound, the organs that deal with sound, and direction, perspective, depth, and balance. It appears that our ears don't just do the job of hearing, but a whole lot more than just hearing. And whenever I hear of bats, for example, I'm told that they are blind. They don't actually see. What they do is that they send out sound impulses in which they use to sort of navigate direction and space. So they'll know that, no, I can't go there because there's a wall, because of the sound that bounces off from them onto the wall and reverberates back somehow. I don't know how it works, but I, as you explained that, my thoughts went to that, and I thought maybe it might be related.
Not to the same extent of what we're discussing. So with bats, they're using very similar to sonar, where they bounce sound out, and then their ears are able to detect the deflections of the sound, and they're able to gauge whether there's an object in front of them or to the left or to the right. So that's not really a sense. To some extent, it is helping the bat determine its sense of guidance, not really a sense of balance. Which is slightly different to how the inner ear functions. So those little semicircular canals are very, very intricately designed. But to simplify it, inside those semicircular canals are tiny little grains, let's call them crystals. And these crystals, if you were to think of a snow globe, are very, very similar. So these crystals are sitting in a snow globe, and in a stationary environment, those crystals are all just lying on the floor at the bottom of the snow globe. Then you turn the snow globe to the left or to the right, and those crystals, through gravity, will start to move. And that's exactly how the inner ear functions. So as we go about our everyday activities, and as we're moving left or right, or up or down, or whatever we're doing, those crystals are bobbing around in the inner ear. And as they deflect, again, back to our snow globe, as they move across the bottom of the snow globe, or as they get dislodged, some crystals would move to the left, some would move to the right. And as they move, they would trigger a neural impulse or a neural response, which tells the brain that you've moved, or you're leaning to the left, or you've swerved to the right, or in some cases, if there's an imbalance, that's when people will say, oh, I get vertigo or I get dizziness, because they know they're standing still, but for whatever reason, one of those crystals has been dislodged, and it's creating the impression, or it's creating the stimulus to the brain that the person or the individual is leaning to the left or right, and that's when that imbalance or that sense of dizziness comes about, and people start to say, oh, I feel very unsteady if I wake up too fast, or if I move too quickly, because for whatever reason, the inner ear is now sending a false signal to the brain that you're moving to the left or right, when in fact you're just standing still. So that's a complication of when one of these crystals seems to have been dislodged.
So I suppose for many of us, when we hear audiologist, we hear the ear, we immediately gravitate towards sound.
Yeah.
To what extent does sound play a role in balance, in all of those faculties? To what extent does sound play a role?
So the two organs, although they're housed in the same structure, are essentially separate. So the cochlea functions almost completely independently, and then the vestibular system functions almost independently. There are some cases where an infection in one can spread to the other, and then you'll get conditions that affect both your hearing and your balance. Sometimes patients exposed to incredibly loud sounds can have damage to both the cochlear portion of the ear, as well as resulting in some form of dizziness because of the sound pressure, the barotrauma that affects the structure as a whole. Then you also get general physical conditions. So conditions that affect blood flow, conditions that affect the quality of the fluid circulating in both the cochlea and the vestibular. vestibular system. Those can also result in conditions that result in a hearing loss and in dizziness. Also, certain medication, strong doses of certain medication can dampen out both the sensitive structures of the inner ear as a whole, so both the cochlea and the vestibular system.
Annie is asking you to talk about cochlear implants. I'm not really sure where the question is going, but yeah, she says, please ask Mr. Naidu about cochlear implants. I'm not really sure what you make of that.
So cochlear implants have been quite a revolution in terms of managing a hearing loss. So in your inner ear, in the cochlear portion of the ear, we have 20,000 little hair cells that pick up sound.
Yeah.
And these hair cells are incredibly sensitive. And they're finely tuned so that we can hear specifically between 0 and 20,000 hertz. Not all of us have a properly formed cochlea. And some individuals later on in life, because of various conditions, may have damage to the cochlea. And I think the simplest way to explain a cochlear implant is it's an electrode that is implanted into the inner ear, into the cochlea. And the purpose is to try and replicate the functioning of those inner hair cells. So the surgeon, as you mentioned earlier, for example, Prof. Schifilaro would go in and they would implant an electrode into the cochlea. This electrode then is mounted onto the mastoid bone, and you clip on a, for clarity, pretty much a very fancy hearing aid.
Mm.
The hearing aid sits on the outside. It picks up sound. It sends the signal via the electrode into the cochlea itself to stimulate the cochlea and the preneural system. And in cases where the rest of the auditory system is healthy, the patient then can hear. So basically, a cochlear implant takes the sound, processes it through a hearing aid, and sends it via the electrode into the inner ear, stimulating the inner ear system and capitalizing on the residual preneural structures of the inner ear and allowing a patient to hear. So it's actually a huge, 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 huge step towards improving hearing care, especially for children that are born with severe sensory hearing loss.
Somebody says, please will you ask about vertigo? My mom has a bad attack of vertigo and there are still lingering effects. So first of all, please, Josiah, what is vertigo and what are the effects of vertigo?
So vertigo, for most people, simply means dizziness. But there are different types of dizziness. Some are caused by lesions in the inner ear system. Some are caused by changes in blood pressure. Some are caused by all sorts of other physiological conditions. But the most common type that most people describe when they talk about vertigo is positional vertigo. So earlier I mentioned the snow globe and how the little crystals move around. Now, in a normal situation, when you shake the snow globe, after a couple of minutes, all those little crystals, all that snow, should settle back in a stationary position at the bottom of a snow globe. In your inner ear, that should also happen. As you move around, those little crystals should float around and provide some stimulus to the brain as to whether you're moving left or right. But for whatever reason, sometimes either somebody's had a bump to the head, certain illnesses, sometimes you bend down too quickly, and you may dislodge one or two of those crystals. So now you have a crystal that didn't settle to the floor. It's stuck somewhere on a tree leaf or on the roof of that house in your snow globe, and it's not supposed to be there. And the fact that it's not supposed to be there means that it's in a position that tells the nervous system that for whatever reason, I'm leaning to the left or I'm leaning to the right. The brain doesn't know that this is a false signal. The brain knows that if the crystal is lying at this particular point, the system is indicating that the patient has moved or the individual has moved to the left. So it sends this false signal to the brain. The brain then conflicts because the visual system is saying, no, 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 but Aubrey's standing still. But the ear is saying Aubrey's leaning to the left. And that's when you get this disorientation and the spinning. You're not sure what's happening, but it feels like the whole world is spinning.
So it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with heights or the fear of heights.
No.
If indeed, nothing to do with that. Okay.
Nothing to do with that. And in theory, it's purely positional. So sometimes people can get up too fast. That one random lone crystal that's not in the right place triggers a response and initiates this whole cycle of dizziness. There's a couple of quick tests that either the audiologist or the ENT can perform that helps you to identify whether in fact it is positional vertigo or not, because you can't treat different types of dizziness in the same manner. And then some of the treatment is very, 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 very simple positioning exercises that patients can do in the comfort of their own bed, in the safety of their own bed. And the aim of that exercise is to gently reposition those crystals back where they should actually be. And in most patients, if you perform those exercises correctly, and if you take the time and you ensure that you're doing it each step properly, most patients report a very, very, very significant reduction in the dizziness and in the incidence of dizziness that they have.
What is the difference, Josiah, between an audiologist and an ENT specialist? I ask this question because here's a question from Solly in Cresta, who says, hi, Orbis, please ask your guest, if I'm getting an imbalance, do I see an ENT or audiologist? What are the differences?
So it would depend. So first, if you're getting an imbalance, you should ideally rule out any other physiological conditions. So your GP would usually be a good first point of call, just to make sure your dizziness is not blood pressure related, blood glucose related, or any other physiological conditions that could also cause lightheadedness, dizziness, and nausea. If we've ruled out all of that and the clues all point to an inner ear condition, then you could see either an audiologist who's able to do the tests and all the non-clinical or non-medical assessments. An audiologist would then say, okay, we've looked at everything based on your case history, based on these signs. We've done a vestibular assessment. Yes, it is a vertigo-related condition. And you, depending on the relationship between the ENT and the audiologist or the proximity, It's usually handled as a team approach. If the audiologist is not sure that it is a vestibular or a benign vestibular or benign positional vestibular condition, then it would be good to refer to the ENT to do further assessments, especially with the central condition, which then suggests that it could be a lesion or a tumor on the auditory nerve or auditory vestibular nerve, vestibular portion of the auditory nerve, or anywhere else in the neural system or the nervous system that could be causing dizziness symptoms. And that's when you'd also work with an ENT, and then the ENT may then also refer to a neurosurgeon or any other specialist, depending on where that tumor or where the cause of this dizziness is coming from.
The term audiologist is deceptive somewhat in that it implies sound, but it's a lot more than that. I mean, it's actually the science, I would imagine, of dealing with ailments that come as a result of vestibular pathologies.
Yes. So it's a huge aspect, and not only vestibular pathologies, there's a whole host of other conditions that people suffer from or experience, including things like tinnitus.
What is that?
Tinnitus is actually a very, very common condition, and it's a sound in your ear. And I don't want to say, a lot of people say, oh, but the ringing sound, but it's not always a ringing sound. Some patients describe a buzzing sound or a humming sound. Some patients say, oh, but it sounds like Christmas beetles in my ear. So it's a sound, whether it's objective or subjective, that a person can hear. And usually it's because it's an inner ear condition. Sometimes it's not inner ear. Sometimes it's beyond the inner ear. And that's when, again, we'd look at a team-centered approach with an ENT and maybe a neurologist to try and identify where on the nervous system the lesion could be. But in many cases, it's as a result of certain medication. So it's a side effect of certain medication. It's as a result of noise exposure. I think a lot of us who may have gone clubbing in our younger days, sometimes if the music is too loud, you step out and you feel this funny ringing sound in your ear. That's pretty much what tinnitus is.
Oh.
Unfortunately, in many cases, it's also a precursor to a hearing loss. So it's often an early warning sign that perhaps the inner ear or those sensitive inner hair cells that we spoke about earlier are not functioning as well as they should. And some of the first signs would be the tinnitus, even before you notice the presence of a hearing loss.
Somebody is sort of explaining, I suppose, let me just try and get that message again. Somebody was explaining the difference between, there you go. It says, importantly, people must differentiate between vertigo and postural hypotension. Though similar, they have very different implications. The latter usually is indicative of underlying issues. Care to elaborate, please, Josias?
Yeah. So as I said earlier, balance is a very complicated process. One of the big contributors to a good sense of balance is the inner ear. But you also have the visual input. You also have your proprioceptive input. So all the nerves, all the muscles, your spinal structure, your body as a whole sends signals up to the brain, because your feet sends a signal to the brain. So you know that you're standing, and that helps the brain to determine your positioning, and also helps sense with the sense of balance. Now, in some patients, they have conditions where there's maybe paralysis, maybe there's numbness of the feet, maybe there's poor sensation below the knee, and sometimes that can also create, it's not exactly the same type of symptoms or presentations as vertigo, but it can present with dizziness or a sense of imbalance because there's not enough information coming from the legs to tell the brain whether you are steady or not, whether you are moving or not, whether you're standing on Lego, whether you're standing on a solid structure, whether you're standing on a spongy structure. So that lack of sensory input can also cause a feeling of imbalance, but that's I'm specifically saying imbalance. It's not dizziness. Dizziness is slightly different in that you feel either you or the world is spinning. Imbalance is I'm walking up the stairs, but I'm not sure if my foot is properly on the step or not. Or if I'm standing, I'm not sure if I'm equally weighted on my left foot or my right foot. And that's a different type of imbalance as compared to the vertigo that we spoke about earlier.
Somebody asks, please ask the audiologist, what happens when someone is drunk and they lose balance? What's going on there?
So that's now, I was avoiding using that as well.
Shall we say inebriated?
Yeah. So that's a different type of dizziness. It's an imbalance because your nervous system is so compromised by the alcohol that you can't adequately determine whether you've taken a proper step forward, whether you've applied the right. So again, not the same as
so where I come from, we'd say you're a pucha. All right, so but that wouldn't be a vestibular issue.
No.
you just got drunk. Oh God. All right, somebody else. Oh, Mfundisi says, ask your guest to expand on the correlation between sniffing glue and vertigo.
So, I'm not too familiar about the specific, if there is a specific link between sniffing glue and vertigo. But in general, certain drugs and certain stimulants can have an effect on how the signal between the vestibular system and the brain functions. So you may have other recreational drugs that have a similar effect where they tend to numb the sensation or numb the process or the speed at which the stimulus from the organ of balance to the brain, and that does create the sense of, again, not necessarily vertigo, but this feeling as though you're in the clouds or that you're walking on cotton wool, that type of feeling. But that's mainly, again, very similar to the alcohol situation, where there's a general numbness in sensation that could be causing this feeling of lightheadedness and imbalance.
So this one is, this listener's asking about ear loss, age 60 plus, hearing loss. Is there long-term disadvantage in delaying getting a hearing aid?
Yes. So the condition they're describing is called presbycusis, which is age-related hearing loss. And as we mentioned earlier, inside the cochlear portion of the inner ear, there are 20,000 little hair cells, which are very, very sensitive, and these help us pick up the different frequencies of sound. As we start to age, general physiological conditions, sometimes our diet, sometimes pre-existing medical conditions, sometimes our history of noise exposure, all sorts of other conditions have an impact on the longevity of these little hair cells. And we find that it's not actually 60, 65, I think the stats are much earlier now. People are actually showing up with age-related hearing loss from as early as 50, 52. We start to see that the high-frequency portion of the inner ear starts to deteriorate, and patients will present with a sloping type of hearing loss. Audiologists will understand more what that means, but basically it tells us that as you go from one end of the ear to the other, the hearing loss starts to get more and more severe. The problem with delaying the identification and management of hearing loss is that because this process is so subtle, it creeps up on us, and it's there. And then you start to lip read, and you start to put the TV a little louder, and you implement all these little coping mechanisms. And that's why a lot of times people had big issues during COVID, because now you took away a coping mechanism when you put on a face mask, because people couldn't lip read anymore. Then suddenly I have a hearing loss, but the hearing loss was there. You were just relying on other cues to help you to hear better. The problem with then leaving it is because this process can take 5, 10, 15 years before it becomes significant enough for you to realize you need to manage it. In that process, the deterioration can spread beyond the cochlea, which means you started off with slightly deteriorating inner hair cells, but now you're starting to see the preneural structures and the neural structures of the auditory nerve also starting to deteriorate because of lack of stimulation, the general aging effects, and a whole host of other conditions. So you end up with a more complicated hearing loss than what you started with. And most recently, I'd say in the last 10 years or so, there's a lot of research that even suggests that this deterioration then spreads to the auditory cortex, or the part of the brain that actually processes sound. And as the auditory cortex starts to deteriorate and the brain starts to receive less information and less stimulation, there's a parallel increase or a higher rate of possibly developing memory loss or dementia as a result of untreated hearing loss. So the sooner you can manage a hearing loss, one, the sooner you can prevent additional or secondary side effects, and also you can improve your quality of life because you manage it at a milder level, you're able to cope better, you're able to hear better, and you never get into that situation where you're feeling like, you know what, you don't want to contribute to conversations because you're not sure if you can follow what everybody is saying.
Judith is in Spain, very good friend of the show. She says, "Hi, Aubrey, please ask your guest, what is Havana syndrome? How does one know if you have been or if you've been affected? And if so, is it something that should be reported and to whom? Have there been any cases in South Africa that have been studied? My daughter got the loud ringing in her ears over a certain period of time. She was 11 or 12 years old at the time. Or is there another possible reason that she had these experiences? Havana syndrome, Josias?"
So it's quite a new, I don't want to say it's a new condition, but it's more recently being reported. I think it started in the last 5 to 10 years where a lot of American military personnel report the tinnitus or the ringing that we spoke about earlier. Why? We're not too sure yet. I think it's still early in terms of research, but it's usually characterized by a very sudden loud noise and a pain in one or both ears, sometimes with a tinnitus, sometimes with vertigo and nausea. And it seems to have affected mainly military individuals. But
from gunshot right now, sounds?
Well, the suspicion is probably that, or exposure to other chemicals, depending where they may have been based, what do they call these, pesticides, alternatively some form of recreational or psychogenic drugs. So right now, it's still early days, and it's not something that there's a lot of literature about it available. So probably for her daughter, try and find, I don't know where her daughter is based, but try and find someone who's a little bit more clued up on this, maybe read up on some of the universities that are doing research and see if she can get in into the research database and see if she could be one of the early candidates for a proper assessment, and maybe through her participation also we can all find out a little bit more about how this condition actually presents itself.
Hi, Aubrey. I'll be 60 this year. Years ago, I had a partial loss of hearing. Over the years, my diabetes complicated to numbness of both legs. Now I have serious imbalance when walking. Is there anything I can do?
So the imbalance, again, is not the same as dizziness and vertigo. So usually patients with a imbalance because of diabetes or any other numbness of the lower extremities would usually recommend those individuals be treated by a physiotherapist, and the physiotherapists have their own approach in terms of how they manage the lower limb conditions and helping you restore some degree of balance. And the other main thing is to make sure that the diabetes is well controlled, because you don't want that progression of the disease. You don't want additional numbness of your toes and feet, and or any other conditions that can come secondary to poorly managed diabetes.
All right, Jeannie is in Melville. Hi, Jeannie.
Hello, Aubrey, and good evening to your guest. I have suspected Meniere's disease, which is, and my left ear, I've suddenly gone virtually deaf, and the vertigo that I'm getting with it is completely and utterly debilitating, and I vomit for anything from about an hour to 3 hours, but the vertigo will last with me incapacitated, leave me incapacitated for about 2 days. I want you to know and understand how dangerous that vertigo is with the extreme vomiting and the incapacitation. I believe that diet, things like coffee can spark it off, sugar and salt. So you keep away from salt and sugar. And that's about, I'm going to be having an MRI shortly, but I would like to know a little bit more about this disease.
Josias, please, if you can help Jeannie, but also perhaps add in your comment about some of the foods that we can perhaps ingest to try and help us mitigate against things such as vertigo and some of the conditions that Jeannie is experiencing.
So Meniere's is a very, very specific condition, and it exists in a triad of symptoms. So you usually will have the vertigo or the dizziness. You would have some degree of hearing loss, and you would have the tinnitus. So that's one of the main ways to diagnose or to identify possible Meniere's is the presence of that triad of symptoms. Then also Meniere's happens in episodes or bouts. So patients can be perfectly fine and then randomly out of the blue have a sudden attack of this Meniere's disease, and then the symptoms would be the vertigo, the tinnitus, and hearing loss. And because of the extreme nature of the dizziness or the vertigo, there will be the associated nausea, which leads to the vomiting and those type of secondary symptoms as a result of the dizziness. So managing it, it would depend. You'd need to start off again in a team-centered approach. The audiologist would test for the hearing loss and for the tinnitus. The ENT would then perform additional tests to try and identify and rule out any other possible causes. The main thing is to exclude the possibility of a central lesion, which can also cause similar symptoms. Then I think she had said that she'd do an MRI, which the MRI would help identify if there is any other condition that could be causing any of these symptoms. And then they begin, if it's purely Meniere's, then they would begin treating symptomatically the Meniere's disease, so that provide medication for the motion sickness. Then they provide things to ease the nausea, and they'd start to manage the condition symptom by symptom. If the hearing loss has become permanent in nature, the audiologist would assist with managing it through the use of a correct hearing aid. Then we'd also look at partnering or bringing in a physiotherapist to assist with some of the balance issues separate to what's happening in the vestibular portion. And then again with your diet, not so much the vertigo that we spoke about earlier, but Meniere's and certain other types of dizziness can be triggered by spikes in salt, caffeine, certain chocolate, alcohol, and I think MSG as well is a trigger to some patients. So removing some of that, making sure that individuals have proper hydration, so your normal 6 to 8 glasses of water, make sure that you're well hydrated, make sure that your diet is pretty balanced, make sure that you're aware of the possibility of Meniere's attacks, so you're not driving alone if you know it could be triggered, you're not climbing upstairs if you know it could be triggered, always have a handrail. A lot of times people are encouraged to put even a handrail in the shower because you don't want to slip. So you start to make all the environmental and lifestyle changes. Because right now, Meniere's as a specific condition, there isn't any direct treatment for Meniere's disease. So it's symptomatic treatment. We don't have any medical cure for for the disease.
Do we know what causes it fundamentally?
So sometimes it's an over secretion of fluid in the vestibular system. So it changes the balance of that of those semicircular canals. It applies too much of pressure on the on those little crystals, and that can be causing the symptoms that she's experiencing.
Just very quickly, some of the foods that we can eat to mitigate against some of these conditions, Meniere's disease, vertigo, and so forth. Is there anything that we can eat that can help us exercise?
It's not so much what we can eat, is what we shouldn't eat. So those the salt, MSG, certain types of chocolate, those type of things, particularly if you've got Meniere's disease. Then we also know that diabetes has a very strong effect on the hearing system. So live a healthy general lifestyle. Make sure that generally you're eating a balanced diet so that you're reducing your risk of diabetes, lowering your exposure to loud noise. Loud noise is very, very harmful to the inner ear. Not taking recreational drugs because many recreational drugs have direct effect on our inner ear. Monitoring some of the medication that we take. A lot of the times medication will tell you that what the side effects are, and it may include tinnitus and hearing loss. We're not encouraging people to stop taking medication, but be aware, report the side effects and the symptoms to your physician or to whoever is prescribing those medications so that the doctor that's caring for you is always on the same page as you. A lot of times people say, oh, no, my medication gives me dizziness, so I just stopped it. That's not how it works. Let your doctor know. Maybe they can change the dosage. Maybe they can move you to a slightly different version of the drug. But don't just stop treatment because you it's causing dizziness or it's causing ringing sounds in your ears. And I think if, in general, people start to live a slightly quieter, especially now in the days of insert earphones, there's definitely the increased risk of noise-induced hearing loss. So just be aware. Sometimes our lifestyle can cause further damage later on. So it's not always just gunshots and heavy machinery. Sometimes just listening to too loud music can actually be causing damage.
Josias, I've got to stop there because we've run out of time. How do people get in touch with you?
So I'm in practice in Johannesburg, in the Sandton and Randburg area. You can get me on 011-883-0023. My office will be happy to schedule an appointment, and we will help you as best we can.
Josias Naidoo, audiologist, thank you so much.